Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. People who work out and eat healthily shouldn't have to pay as much for life insurance. That's the concept behind Health IQ. They use data, science, and statistics to show insurance companies that health-conscious people deserve lower rates on their life insurance. This actually happened to me. After the birth of my first child, my husband and I decided we needed life insurance. It was a very pleasant surprise that my final quote was half the amount of the original quote because I was so healthy. 56% of Health IQ customers save 4 to 33% on their life insurance. Health IQ can save their customers up to 33% because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, 20% lower risk of cancer, and 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are not active. These savings are exclusive to Health IQ. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/YBB or mention the promo code YBB when you talk to the Health IQ agent. Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Welcome to Yoga, Birth, Babies, a podcast produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. We will be diving into everything prenatal yoga, birth, and baby-related, hoping to inspire, educate, and empower you through your journey into motherhood. Thank you for listening. Hi, everyone. I'm Deb Flaschenberg, and I'm your host for Yoga Birth Babies. And today we're going to look a bit about the biology and culture and how it shapes our parenting. So as I was researching guests and kind of thinking what's next for the podcast, I came across Meredith Small's book, Our Babies, Ourselves, and I was just enthralled by it. So I asked her to come on, and here she is. So let me tell you first a little bit about Meredith. Meredith Small is a writer and professor at Cornell University and a visiting scholar in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Small received her PhD in biological anthropology from the University of California, Davis, and spent several years studying the behavior of monkeys in captivity and in the wild. Although trained as a primate behaviorist, Small is now most interested in how the intersection of biology and culture influence human behavior. Besides numerous publications in academic journals, Dr. Small is also a science journalist. Her work has appeared in Discover, Natural History, Scientific America, and New Science, among many other magazines and newspapers. Small is also a regular commentator on the National Public Radio's All Things Considered. Hi, Meredith. How are you?
I'm good. Good.
Thank you for joining me.
Oh, I'm happy to be here.
Oh, thanks. So what inspired you to write Our Babies, Ourselves?
At the time, I was an anthropologist trained as a primate behaviorist, a biological anthropologist, but I had started writing for the popular press, and by that I mean Discover, Natural History, science magazines, New York Times, whatever, and I was carrying around in my back pocket a reporter's notebook, one of those long, skinny notebooks, little spiral notebooks. And even though I was teaching anthropology at Cornell, this was my passion to communicate to the public different ideas, anthropological or whatever. And I had a friend, still have a friend named Jim McKenna, who some of your readers or your listeners might know as the guy who's done all the work on mother-infant co-sleeping. But mm-hmm. at that time, Jim was, like me, he had been a primate behaviorist, and he had been my teaching assistant. I had been his student at San Diego State at one point. And, you know, life went on. And then one day I read a tiny little thing in Glamour magazine, you know, Jim McKenna says something, something, sleeping babies, whatever. So I ran into him at some anthropology meetings and I said, hey, Jim, I hear you're studying mothers and infants and sleeping. And Jim, who's a very enthusiastic kind of person, said to me, Meredith, if you have a baby, sleep with it. And at that point, I took that pad out of the back of my pocket and I took a pen and I just said, tell me about it. So he did. And then he told me there was a meeting at the American Anthropological Association coming up, and there were going to be all these people who were announcing a new discipline called ethnopediatrics, and I should come. And so I did. And I sat in the audience. There were about 20 people in the audience, and it was a panel of human development people, anthropologists, research pediatricians, and every single person stood up and, to me, said the most fascinating thing. And at that time, I didn't have any children, so this was different for me. I'd studied baby monkeys, but not human children. And I was writing furiously, and I went home, and I called up my editor at Doubleday, Roger Scholl, and I said, blah, 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 and he said, go. And we just knew. We knew we had something new and exciting and a whole different perspective. But I think at that time, I didn't realize how really monumental it was, or that this book would be. It was an amazingly great experience for me. And to be clear, I wasn't writing about my own work. I was writing about the work of other people. And I think it must be a self-selected group, people who study babies, because they were all wonderful. Every person, open to me, coming to visit, looking at their research, talking to them. It was a fabulous experience.
What were you hoping people would take away from reading your book?
The same thing that I hope 18-year-olds take away when I'm talking to them, standing in front of a classroom. I think anthropology, the way I look at it, is that it's a perspective that is different from many other perspectives, let's say psychology or economics or history or any of those things. And the perspective to me is twofold. It's evolutionary, meaning deep in time, and it's broad in scope, meaning across cultures. So whenever I think about anything, I think about possible evolutionary history, why is it there? And then I think across cultures. And we in Western culture are so narrowly focused on our own culture that we don't usually realize there's a really big world out there, and that humans have been around for about 5 million years, and we're just a tiny little dot in all that. So if somebody wants to say people act a certain way, well, you have to convince me that people around the world act that way for me to believe that statement. So my job has always been to kind of open up the narrow envelope that we all live in, that we all, you know, we all have our belief systems. And that's how I approached Our Babies Ourselves. I had written a couple other books. They took the same sort of perspective on other subjects. And so I wanted to just explore that. And these researchers allowed me to do that.
That's something that I was really drawn to, is being a parent of young kids. I definitely feel like I have the influences, which you talk about in the book, of how I was brought up in my community and, you know, our society, the bigger society. And what I was intrigued by was the opportunity to see other cultures and open my mind. So let's jump in a little bit to, what is ethnopediatrics? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yes, yes, you are. And I have to say that it was a very exciting discipline to get off the ground, but it doesn't seem at this point to have really gone anywhere. When they first came up with the idea, it was different from the way I had learned about why anthropologists at least studied children, which they had since the 1940s, which was to find out, how does culture influence the kind of adult citizen you became? Ethnopediatricians wanted to look at how culture and parenting styles affect the way babies behave, just the babies themselves. So that made it different and made it not just anthropological in that sense. And for a couple of years there, some people got some funding, and then just sort of, I don't know what happened. It kind of faded away. The people who do the research are still doing it, but to my knowledge, they don't consider themselves a collective group.
Okay. Yeah. I thought it was interesting about the idea of looking at how people become the adults they are. Can you talk about the importance of bonding between the baby and the mother figure?
Yeah, I come from this also, as I said, as a primate behaviorist. And to bring in the personal, I have one child. I mean, she's 20, but we always carried her. She always slept with us. And people would say to me, would you have done that if you hadn't written this book? Well, in fact, I had written the book, and I was she was in a front pack, as I call it, while I was looking at the galleys. But in reality, everything I wrote in that book made perfect sense to me. I didn't need to be convinced of anything. And I spent much of my life before that time watching macaque monkeys. And it would never have occurred to me to do anything but hold my child all the time or sleep with her. It just wouldn't occur to me. And I realized at the time that was sort of different, but I guess I had enough faith in how non-human primates act to know that that's how it should be done, in the sense of everybody being comfortable. So I forget the how did you ask me?
It's about the importance of bonding between the mother and the baby. So yeah, as I was, my questions are basically from, I went through your book and the things that really leapt out at me, and I'm like, oh, I really want to go deeper into this. That's where my questions are based from. And so there's a section about that I thought that was intriguing.
There, the history of the whole idea of bonding, of course, is very interesting in itself. So in both the popular and the academic literature, it was really John Bowlby who made the difference. And he was a psychiatrist, classically trained psychiatrist, but he began to question the need for disconnecting, babies being disconnected from their parents, which is a very Victorian idea, upper class Victorian. And then Mary Ainsworth worked on babies in Africa. And then really, in my mind, the most important thing was what happened with the study of rhesus monkeys. And when monkeys were taken away from their little baby monkeys, were taken away from their mothers, when those babies grow up, they don't know how to mother. And this, of course, is Harry Harlow's work. And he really changed the way we think about mothers and babies together. And then there were two guys, Clausen and Kinnell, and they were the ones who really pushed for babies not being taken away in the hospital. But this was quite a revolution. We think of it now, that's normal, but it isn't even normal all over America. Babies are often taken away from their mothers in the hospitals. But the history of all this has always been so odd to me. Like when my daughter was born, about a year later, an interviewer said to me, well, and what do you think of attachment parenting? And in fact, I'd never heard of it. And I said, it was kind of a new word then. My response was, what other kind is there? Mm-hmm. How could it be anything but attachment? And that got me to think a lot about it, that there had to be a revolutionary movement, that it was okay to attach to your babies, your infants, your young children, your teenagers, whatever, your partner, that this was something that Western culture, especially American culture, really has a hard time with. And in contrast to everywhere else in the world, where people are just carrying their kids around and kids are part of their lives, and that brought me to thinking about the influence of culture and how weird Western culture is.
What do you think accounts for that other cultures very much wear their baby, have them more involved in the family, whereas you're saying in American families is more of a separation? I know you talk about the sleep, like, babies have their own room, which I have to admit, I have young kids and I like having them have their own room because I sleep better and I feel like I'm a less
cranky.
Yeah,
everybody gets to do what they want, you know, as long as it's positive. It's not really my place to tell people what to do. Mm-hmm. And my editor at the time said, you know, your book is not a how-to book, it's a how-come book.
Right, which
and
is what I liked.
Really what I'm coming from. And for me personally, I had one child. I would have been up all night making sure she was alive. So I slept much better with her, because I would have been up and down and up and down and up and down. My older sister actually taught me the trick with licking your fingers and putting it in front of the baby's face to make sure the baby's still alive, still breathing, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But anyway,
So what accounts for that other cultures are more attachment based than the American culture?
Well, everything we do as people is influenced, as you said, by your own upbringing, but it's also influenced by what anthropologists call a belief system. And that belief system is everything that comes into your life. It's kind of a nebulous idea, but when I say to you belief system, somewhere that registers, oh, right. It could be your ethnicity. It could be family traditions. It could be religion. It could be politics, economics. And in fact, if you look at different cultures, they have particular belief systems. And the only way to really understand them is to do a comparison. And so, for example, if you think about, which you probably haven't before, but if you think about hunters and gatherers, these are people who economically are making a living by walking long distances, getting food on the landscape, coming back to a home base. And their belief system is that the group is a collective and a very tight collective, and people are in some way or another related by kinship, and therefore they operate as a group. And what's important to them in parenting is sharing. It's about sharing and exchange. If you compare that, let's say, to white middle-class American values, where we believe historically from our pilgrim roots until our modern capitalist economics that a person's supposed to make it on their own. The strongest person, the most successful person, is the one who gets through life by standing up and going it alone. So we believe that our babies and our children should be taught to be self-reliant and independent. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of research that has actually talked to parents in different cultures with the simple question, what is it you want for your child? And by and large, Americans say, I want my child to be healthy. And then they say, I want my child to be self-reliant and independent. Whereas someone in some other group in Asia, South Asia, Africa, but just about everywhere else, that would not even come up. It would be about family connection, kinship connection. And so those are the belief systems that we aren't born with genetically, but they are part of how we're socialized. And they are so deeply ingrained that we really don't know they're there until we hear some other way. And then we usually go, oh, I didn't even think of that. Oh, you could do it some other way.
Well, it was interesting when I was reading that you often mentioned about American parents push for strong independence as a parenting goal. But I know this book was written a bit ago. I feel like when I was being brought up, and granted, I'm a little on the older side, yes, there was that push, but I definitely feel like the last 20 years, or maybe even the last 15 years, that has shifted because of such over-involved helicopter parents, where I've even heard stories of like parents going to college professors and saying, you're a college professor, maybe this has happened to you.
Oh, yes, about, this like, has happened
why
to me.
My child needs to be retested. Why did you give that grade? Mm-hmm. Which actually goes against the idea of independence, where they're saying, you know, I'm going to step in. So do you feel like there's been a shift since you originally studied and worked on this book?
Yoga Birth Babies is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, cyclists, weightlifters, yogis, and vegetarians get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/YBB to support the show and see if you qualify.
I think that the population that you're talking about is actually very small. And I certainly know parents like that. And I certainly try not to be that kind of parent. And that has more to do, more than anything, it has to do with the decrease in the birth rate. So when I was little, I was one of four, and we were the people that didn't have very many kids. All my cousins are one of six, one of eight. Friend down the street here, she was one of 10. In a generation, because of access to decent birth control, boom, women choose to have fewer children. And the effect on that is so widespread, it sort of surprises me that no one has really looked at that as an important variable. So if people only have one child or two children, they have more time to spend on those children. But also, when you talk about helicopter parents, they tend to be parents who are not successful economically, not always, educationally high level, but not always. We also have a time where people believe their children aren't safe. And so some of that, you know, if you add drugs and alcohol, people who aren't helicopter parents suddenly become them when their children are teenagers. There is a, I'm not saying that my mother let us run around and play by ourselves because she figured she had four and if she lost one, no big deal. But I think that you just don't have that much time when you have six kids, even if mom isn't working. There just isn't that much time. Parents have more time. Many parents who don't have the money will sacrifice to send their kid to some particular school, preschool, whatever. But if they had six of those kids, they couldn't do that. But I would say by and large, and I don't know if anyone's ever done a census on helicopter parents or the new one, snowplow parents.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know that term. What? Yeah, well, can you explain that one?
I'm from Ithaca, New York. You know, we know snow. They just push everything out of the way for their children.
Okay.
You know, they and so their kids can have a perfect life. And of course, we know from reading the papers and everything, there's a lot of controversy about that. And you're absolutely right. I have been the victim of that with some of my students, but it's few of them. It's very few. In my 28 years of teaching at Cornell, I can tell you maybe two instances in which a parent did something obnoxious. And most of the kids, maybe they talked to their parents, but those parents never interfered with me. So I don't know. I just think it's such a small percentage. If we went out on the street, if I went on the streets of Philadelphia here, I wouldn't find so many parents like that.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to get back to some of the things on your book. So can you explain the idea of culture and personality? Is that what you were basically referring to, that the American culture has certain goals and that's what's influencing the personality? And I guess what it means in terms of parenting?
Yeah, that term culture and personality actually means something very specific to anthropologists. And it comes from work by a woman named Ruth Benedict in the 1940s. And she was Margaret Mead's teacher. And she wrote the idea that whatever culture you live in influences the kind of person and citizen you become. Now, in these days, we kind of step back from that a little bit, because then it sounds like we're stereotyping everybody. But Benedict meant it in a very broad way. And so in my book, I mean it in the way of the kind of cultural belief that we carry in our heads that sometimes we don't even know we have until we have children. And then suddenly it kicks in as if that's what's normal. There's a great example from Robert Levine, who studied people in Western Kenya for a long time, and they did some filming of American parents changing the diapers of their babies and American grandparents doing that. They showed it to the people of the group that they studied in West Kenya, and those people said, "What is wrong with these mothers and these grandmothers? Can't they change a baby? Because the baby is screaming and whatever." And of course, if the American parents saw film of the way the babies in West Kenya are treated, they would say, why is that six-year-old carrying around that baby? Why isn't a parent doing that? So we come with these sets of ideas that we think of as normal. And it always gets back to the concept of normal, what our culture, what our family, what our friend group thinks of as normal. And there's lots of different normal in the world, lots.
Yeah, I remember reading that about the six-year-old carrying the baby. And I thought, because I have a six-year-old, and I'm like, would I feel comfortable letting him walk around holding a baby? Probably not,
The difference is, of course, that six-year-old who's standing there in West Kenya has been involved in that baby's life from the moment it was born.
Right.
And has been playing with that baby and holding that baby. And there is always an adult around. They're not wandering around by themselves with a six-year-old. There mm-hmm. are people all around. But the majority of child care in the world is done by other children. It's not done by adults.
That's interesting. I thought that was really fascinating. Let's talk a little about parenting goals. How have you seen these parenting goals differ in different cultures? Because that's something I thought was great, just learning, kind of peeking into these other cultures, because I'm so enrooted in what I know.
Yeah. And again, Robert Levine and his wife, Sarah Levine, have a book that just came out in the last couple of years, which addresses this quite well. And he says that you could almost divide these parental goals. On one side, you have people who have a very high infant mortality rate, and their goals are basically to keep that baby alive. So if you're losing 50% of your infants to respiratory ailments, excuse me, that was my cat. Go away. If you're losing 50% of the children that you have, what parents do, they're very concerned about keeping those babies safe and whatever beliefs they have about making sure the babies are safe. That is the primary thing. In Western culture, where we have medicine and we have penicillin, you know what I mean? We have antibiotics, which have pretty much taken care of childhood illnesses that will kill kids. We have time to think about other things. And so we think about educating them so that they can become, go to school, go to college, be successful, get trained in some job so that they will become independent. Where the other people are trying to keep those babies safe so they grow up, and then those children contribute to the household. So in other cultures, non-industrialized cultures, these kids are really contributing. They're doing the childcare. These are age-appropriate jobs. It's not, you know, child labor. They're maybe helping with weeding in the fields. They're maybe carrying fire, you know, sticks for the fire. So they contribute to the economy. So the whole idea of why you have children and how many children you have is determined by these other factors like healthcare, like birth control, all these other, we could call them sociological or economic factors.
Mm-hmm. And you also talk about the way that other cultures even view babies, compared to the American culture. Can you expand on that?
I'd love to. My friend Alma Gottlieb, who is an anthropologist from Illinois and now is at Brown, she was just here at Penn giving a talk. And Alma studied the Beng people of West Africa. And I think they're the best example of and when I talk about the book Our Babies Ourselves, I begin with her work because she spent a year studying Beng babies. And she's really the only person who has done a complete ethnography on infants. And she said the Beng, who are a very spiritual people, and they believe that babies come from, you can't really call it an afterlife, but a pre-life. They come from another place. And when they're born, they're really not yet of this world. That, in fact, they're back at their other world where they had parents and they had a full life and they could understand many languages. And they come into this world And then once the umbilical cord comes off, which is in about 8 days there, then it's a many month process until that child is really truly in this world. And the difference is that the Beng believe that babies are fully competent spiritual beings, whereas we see babies as these lumps that can't do anything. They can't sit up, they can't walk, they can't feed themselves. In Bengland, the babies are respected. They're totally respected as complete beings. And if you don't take care of them, they will choose to go back to their other parents. And so diviners are brought in, the baby's crying a lot. It's just a whole different idea of how we conceive of babies, so to speak.
Yeah, I actually had a conversation with this woman, Michelle Conti, and she had this idea. She works with babies and mothers, and the way she talked about kind of the same idea is that she called it, I believe it's big brains, little bodies, or big mm-hmm. beings, little bodies, that mm-hmm. there's a lot more going on in these little bodies than we give them credit for.
Well, there's that, and even you saying that is sort of a Western idea. It reminds me of Alison Gopnik's work, the Scientist in the Crib, that we have underestimated. I mean, certainly in the 50s and the 60s, we underestimated how much babies knew, how much they understood, how social they were, how they recognized faces, etc. But the Beng example is almost hard for Westerners to understand, because they're saying it's not about them being smart. It's about them having a full life. They are full, complete beings mm-hmm. when they arrive here. And this is just so hard for us to even imagine. That's why I like it.
Yeah, I'm trying to wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
I'm going to keep going. I liked the part you talked about sleep, that different cultures have different relationships to parent-child sleeping. And you touched upon that, you know, that you wouldn't have thought not to have your baby with you. Can you talk a little bit about the different sleep patterns that you saw throughout different cultures?
Well, I'm influenced a lot by Jim McKenna's work, because he is the only person who's actually wired up babies and mothers and attached them to EEGs and stuff. And he says there is a sleep tango that happens. The baby goes through levels of sleep, the mother does, back and forth. And if they're sleeping together, if the baby has an apnea, the mother, breathing out CO2 makes the baby breathe again. And Jim says they're really designed to be entwined. And it doesn't necessarily have to be mother. In other cultures, mother is breastfeeding, and so the baby is next to her. And he says that's the natural position, really. Mother on her side, baby on their side. And the baby does most of the moving around to get to the nipple. And in Western culture, what we've done historically is bop this line that if the baby's in bed with you, you'll probably roll over and kill it. And that comes from, Jim says, from medieval times, when people were actually, in fact, committing infanticide because they just couldn't have any more children. And so laws were enacted. And then you add into that what we have in Western culture, which is the sexualization of the bed. And you don't have a baby in there because that's where you have sex. That's how we think of it. Well, the bed itself isn't necessarily a sexualized place in other cultures. An anthropologist friend of mine once said, who was working in Nepal, she said, I would just like to lie down and take a nap. But every time I try to do that, someone comes in and sleeps next to me, because they could not imagine anyone sleeping by themselves, how terribly lonely that would be. But in America especially, we believe you should, as Jim puts it, you should go to bed at 11 o'clock and basically die until 7 o'clock in the morning. But in fact, across cultures, people are awake all the time during the night, and humans are really biphasic sleepers. The problem is, we don't get a nap because we go to work. So we don't get that second part of it.
Okay. But I mean, there is a lot of research, and I'm trying not to be combative, but there is a fair amount of research about beds being too soft, babies rolling over and suffocating themselves.
No, absolutely. If you read all the research, which actually it pretty much started in New Zealand, the most important thing, the things are the soft bedding, as you mentioned, you know, duvet covers, that sort of stuff. Sleeping on a sofa, actually, with the baby turns out to be a hazard because the baby can fall between. If the parents are drunk, intoxicated, or drug addicts, or obese, these are high risks.
Okay, yeah, I just wanted to clarify, especially if listening, yeah, sure. For those who are listening, they'd be like, oh, okay, I can sleep with my baby. But there are parameters and guidelines if that's something someone's choosing.
One would hope those would make some common sense, you know, in that way. Around the world, babies, except for Western culture, and especially North America, babies, if they don't sleep in a bed or a hammock or on some platform with someone, they're in the same space as another adult. And often, once they're not breastfeeding and they're little kids, they're sleeping with other kids. So they're between a, so nobody's really sleeping alone. Whereas we really, there's something about controlling that issue that is so, I just have to say, crazy in America. And I've seen this change in the last 20 years where it's become this firestorm of anger and craziness about where the baby sleeps. And, you know, people are fighting within families. Husbands and wife are fighting. And part of me doesn't get it because it's not a very long time. And if you don't, if you don't sleep well and your baby's there, well, then put it somewhere else. You know, I don't, it's become an ideologically point, flashpoint for people.
Yeah.
I see. On the same level as breastfeeding. These are ideological flashpoints.
That's what I was just going to say. I think my next two areas I'm going to touch upon can be a big can of worms. I wanted to ask a little bit. So the next, so the things are breastfeeding I want to talk about and crying. Because one thing I thought that was really interesting is you were saying Western babies cry more than other places. And I would love to know what your interpretation of that is. Like, why? Why do Western babies cry more?
That's the work of Ron Barr, who's a Canadian pediatric researcher. And again, when I wrote about these people in Our Babies Ourselves, they had real research that they had done. And Ron Barr says that and he worked also not only on Canadian babies, but also on Kung San hunter-gatherers babies as well. So he had a comparison of two cultures, even though he's not an anthropologist. But he was able to chart, you know, like writing down how much crying happens. And he says that the frequency of crying is the same around the world, if you call frequency the initiation of crying. So, but the difference is that Western babies cry for longer periods. So I don't remember the exact numbers, but let's say all babies at 2 months initiate crying 15 times a day. But American babies are crying for 15 to 30 minutes long, and the other babies are crying for 2 minutes. So in total, Western babies cry more, and it's really quite simple. It has to do with feeding. Human breast milk is actually very low in fat. It's not like a seal, you know. Seal milk is really high in fat because the mothers go off. They dive away to get fish. But human infants are really designed, and human mother's milk is designed to be delivered continuously. And I've always hated that phrase, on demand, because really it's on cue. And in other cultures where babies are held all the time, very quickly the baby is moving over and grabbing the nipple. And so it's not such a big deal as it in Western culture where you have to sit down and get the pillow and, you know, get out of public view and, you know, it becomes this huge ritual. But babies in other cultures, what Ron said was if you look at La Leche League, the average is every hour and a half. And that in other cultures, it's like every couple of minutes. And so what happens is that when a baby starts getting fed in intervals, the prolactin will go down and the mother will ovulate again. So people will say to me, I'm breastfeeding, but I got pregnant again, you know, in a year. Well, that's because they weren't breastfeeding at night or they were breastfeeding every 2 hours. So it's a very different pattern. Now, we get to choose this stuff. You know, if we decide we don't want to breastfeed, well, then we don't. You know, it's neither here nor there. I mean, we know that the immunological properties are much better if you breastfeed. That doesn't mean your kid's going to die if they don't breastfeed. Mm-hmm. And so it's become, you know, I hate to see that kind of anger among women just at a point where post-feminist revolution, we're supposed to be in this together. I also hate to see that being a mother was something that women did that men couldn't do, you know, by definition, being a mother. And to have that fraught with this kind of contention, it is really awful. And I also see that it happens during, until kids walk and talk, and then all that goes away because that issue is no longer important. It just goes away.
Well, that also brings up some of the social acceptance for how long to breastfeed.
Oh,
is there social acceptance? Like, you know, as you mentioned, women feel like they have to cover up. What do you see in other cultures about that acceptance and the support to breastfeed right. and how long they should breastfeed? And is there encouragement to breastfeed?
Well, they don't have any choice because in all those cultures, except for ones that have been influenced by the West, there's no baby formula. So, you know, it's either mother's milk or it's nothing. But the other thing is around the world, women have forever supplemented breast milk. And some very quickly, very, very quickly, some kind of gruel, some kind of chewed up food. And so it's not as if women in those other cultures are only doing breastfeeding. And, you know, you always have to be worried about the noble savage idea, you know, that, oh, they're doing it right. We're doing it wrong. And we're just doing it differently. We have the luxury of using quote unquote baby formula because we have clean water. And so we can wash bottles or we have plastic liners. People in other cultures, they don't have that luxury. They have to just keep breastfeeding because that's all there is.
What about other industrialized cultures that do have these things? Like, I know you talk about the Japanese for certain things and how they revere babies and how they sleep. You mentioned the Dutch culture. Do you have any feedback about the other industrialized cultures and their view of breastfeeding?
Well, I certainly, having spent a lot of time in Europe, I've seen it sort of change. And of course, every country in Europe is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
In Italy, where I spend a lot of time, the family is still incredibly important, where grandparents do a lot of the childcare, but also the birth rate that in Spain are the lowest in the Western world. You know, so again, the influence of birth rate. I just saw a woman breastfeeding in a coffee place here, and nobody seemed to care. And we have so few babies because of the low birth rate. The opportunities are so very small. When I was writing about breastfeeding and I was on an airplane thinking to myself, you know, I haven't seen anyone breastfeed in public in like 15 years. And then I sat down and the woman next to me was breastfeeding. And so I turned to her and her child was older, you know, like a one-year-old. And I talked to her about it and said, boy, you're the first person I've seen do that. We also have in this culture a sort of almost fear of breastfeeding, that it's really hard to do. And of course, in other cultures where there is no alternative, there's no time for that. And I was giving a talk at La Leche League International once, and we were talking about these issues after my talk, and a gentleman stood up, and I don't remember where he was from. It could have been Bangladesh, but I'm not sure. And he said, we find that we only have insufficient milk syndrome, which is, you know, a made-up thing, in places where baby formula is available. So, you know, there it is. Would babies die under these circumstances? Probably not. Somebody else might feed them. But it's odd that in the best fed culture in the world, people say they have, you know, they can't make enough milk. I don't know. I don't study that itself, but I don't know what to say about that.
Yeah, it's definitely something to chew on. So since this book has been published a bit ago, has anything changed since in your approach to this work or any other studies that have come out since you originally published?
Well, there's been a lot of work. It's nice to see some work on infants and children. And again, Alma Gottlieb has been instrumental in bringing that work by other researchers in her two books, A World of Babies, 1 and 2. And I do see that, at least at the university level, there are more courses like my own, The Anthropology of Babies. And I also think that, at least in America, we've always been a multicultural society, but now many of those different cultures are stronger in their traditions than, say, when I was born in the 1950s. And so we're even more used to seeing people of all different kinds around us. And that just becomes common. Mm-hmm. And within, I mean, I've always wanted to study the history of parenting advice in America because for exactly this reason is it changing? How is it changing? Why is it changing? And I suspect decrease in the birth rate has a lot to do with it, but I'd like to hear from people themselves exactly what they're thinking. And I think it's very easy to get caught up in the educated white upper middle class idea as this is the standard American belief system. It's certainly the one that pediatricians, if they get a chance, that's the one they go with. They don't sleep with your baby, you know, breastfeed, but only do it for 4 months, discipline your child. But that isn't the way everybody operates. You know, I'll tell you, I have a niece and nephew, and they're in their late 30s. And my sister said to me that she slept with both her children, but she never told anybody because she knew they wouldn't approve. And she said, they were the happiest years of my life. And now you can say you sleep with your kids. Some people might not like it, but you know other people are doing it. So I see some difference, but I also see of, you know, people in their 20s and 30s being very worried a lot about parenting. And that's a shame because it's a lot of fun. And I worry that we're taking the fun out of parenting with all this worry. And how do you do it right? You know, there's necessarily a right way to do it.
I think you're absolutely spot right on about that. Yeah, I think so. Like I was just speaking with one of my students the other day, and she feels badly that she didn't put her child into a twos preschool program here. And I said, you know, we happen to do it because I needed the hours of, you know, childcare, basically. And it worked.
Sure.
But, sure. And I said, but I really don't think that it's going to influence the rest of his life. And she's like, I'm so glad you said it because that's what I've been thinking. I think, you know, there's a lot of us that put a lot of pressure on ourselves to do it quote unquote right, and that we need to allow for more fun. And I love hearing that because it's a great reminder that we have kids because it's supposed to be enjoyable and that we want to share our time with them. I think there's hard moments too, but it's a great reminder that, you know, it's not just an arduous journey. It should be, you know, a joyous place as well.
That's right. When my daughter was born, a friend of mine said there are rewards and challenges at every age. And that phrase has always stuck with me, and I think it's completely right. And I hate to see women made to feel lesser than or made to feel insecure about what they're doing, because this was one arena in which we didn't feel insecure. And, you know, I just wonder what society has done to do this to women in particular. There are lots of dads who are insecure as well about what they're doing. But, you know, my father once said to me, so this was a man who had 4 children in 7 years, you know, so he had a pretty busy life. And he once said to me, parenting is the most important job of your life. And then he paused and he said, but most of the time you're flying by the seat of your pants. And that's really it. Nobody has the exact right answer. And you don't have to have particular goals for your children. And in fact, people who have studied children or even parenting styles, no one has ever shown that a particular kind of suite of parenting style produces a particular kind of person. There is no research showing that if I do this, this, and this with my kid, they will turn out to be a CEO. Or if I do this, this, and this, they will turn out to be living under a bridge. You know, it just, life isn't that clean. And so you kind of do your best and love them and do what, as long as it's positive, what feels right to you. And I've often said to people, oh, don't listen to anybody. Don't even listen to me. You know, just, you know, what feels right. And when I've been around the world giving talks about this stuff, and people would come up to me afterwards and say, this is what I did with my kids. That's what felt right to me. Or I wanted to do this, but my husband wouldn't let me, and it became a big conflict. And I just think, oh my goodness, it's so fraught. Parenting has become fraught. And I say, wait till they're 13, then you can be fraught.
But I think a lot of people, myself included, will just have that big sigh of relief that I was wondering, like, is there a study that shows that no matter what, this is good? So just to hear that, you know, it can vary so much. And there, as much as behavior studied, as much as parenting styles are studied, that there is no one solid answer that, you know, different kids are going to respond to different things, different cultures, parenting. And I think that's a sigh of relief.
And I think in that we also suffer from a decrease in the birth rate because if you come from a big family, you only have to look at your sisters and brothers to know that, oh, we all grew up in the same household and look how different we are.
Mm-hmm.
In what we believe in and how we act and what our ambitions are and our politics. And we don't have that anymore. Mm-hmm. Well, most people don't. We don't have the comparison. And so what we do is we look to other families. Well, what did they do? Their kid is, you know, going to Princeton, as if that were the goal.
Right.
You're like, what's the goal?
Right. Well, as we start to wrap up, is there anything else that you want to put out there to the community?
Just relax. Try to relax. Enjoy it. That old saying, the days go by slowly, but the years go quickly. It's absolutely true. And if I could get on a bus right now and land on the campus of Columbia University and take my 20-year-old daughter and put her in a front pack or a backpack and carry her around, I would do it. But she won't let me.
No, and it'd probably be pretty heavy.
probably be a little heavy. But, you know, I would do it. I would drag her. And I'm sure she knows that. She actually said to me when she turned 20, she said, oh, well, Mom, I'm 20. I'm not a teenager anymore. And I think we're both glad about that. And I said, speak for yourself. I'm not.
Yeah.
I want her to stop growing.
Oh, I think we all have that moments. Well, I wanted to thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. And I really enjoyed reading your book and having a chance to talk to you about it.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Well, enjoy your day. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. This has been an episode of Yoga Birth Babies, produced by Prenatal Yoga Center. You can catch us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Periscope. I'm Deb Flaschenberg. Thanks for listening.